Welcome to Coming From Experience, my virtual campfire where we can all gather round and share our experiences through this little thing called life. I'm your host, Annalise, and I'm here to bring you the raddest people I've come to know, sharing their stories of growth, evolution, and their unique take on universal experiences. The stories and experiences I bring to you in this podcast will span a wide variety of topics, from career changes to motherhood, personal development, spirituality, growth in relationship, health and wellness, and so much more. I hope that these stories inspire you and open up a portal for deep connection and conversation on topics that would otherwise be left untouched. Let's dive in. Finding what you had in mind. Welcome back, beauties. Today I have Tina Pullen joining me on the podcast. Now, Tina is an expert in all things birth, hypnobirth. She is hilarious. I had the best chat with her and she is such a vibe. If you haven't followed her on social media, please do. She's at the.birth.collective. She brings a really grounded attitude to birthing and pregnancy. And I think it's one that we can all kind of sigh a breath of air and just really relate to and have a lot of synergy with. We talk about so much in this podcast. Listening back, I was kind of like, we really covered a lot here, you know, from I guess what hypnobirthing even is, the comparison between a natural birth and a cesarean birth and even an induced birth, and how you can still apply the practices of a hypnobirthing course to those birthing experiences. We also looked at the importance of informed choice and having a birth preference plan. So knowing what your preferences are in birth experience and how to kind of be supported in that environment with midwives and doulas. We also looked at home birth versus hospital birth, the importance of continuity in care, you know, the importance of having a doula and should you have a doula, and so much more. It was a juicy conversation and let's dive in, I say. Hey, Tina, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited to talk to you today all about birth, pregnancy, all women's business. I know you love talking about it probably as much as I do.
Yep, a bit too much, some people would say.
Nah, never too much. Before we dive into all of that, though, I really just want to get an understanding of who you are. You know, how do you spend your day? What does that look like? So everyone can connect with you and understand a little bit more about you.
Yeah, so I don't like to use the word juggle, but my day is a flow from being a mum of two. So I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And having my business as well. So I'm a Hypnobirthing Australia practitioner and I have my business called The Birth Collective, where I help parents prepare for a positive birth experience. So my day involves, you know, doing the general business admin stuff, marketing, and supporting my parents where they need it. And then of course, planning for my group and private classes. So, there's no set structure to any day. It's just that flow and squeezing in any work, I guess, wherever I can around my kids' lives.
It's really about that, isn't it? It's like, where can I get my time in?
Yep, pretty much.
Yep, fair enough. Now, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your hypnobirthing program and being a Hypnobirthing Australia practitioner. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what it involves, what it looks like for anyone that maybe doesn't know?
Yeah, so I teach the Hypnobirthing Australia Positive Birth Program, which is all about preparing parents to have a positive birth, no matter how that birth unfolds. A lot of my clients go in preparing for a natural birth because that's what they would prefer. Yeah. But they also have the skills to keep calm no matter what happens and know that they can make informed decisions. Yeah. So it's giving them the knowledge to make informed decisions. Being an active decision maker, not going into the hospital and essentially being a patient and being told what to do. They're really making those decisions for themselves and giving them tools and techniques to keep calm and release endorphins throughout the labor.
Yeah.
Because we're actually designed to produce copious amounts of endorphins throughout our labor. And this is because it's nature's pain relief. And what happens when we are stressed or fearful is that adrenaline can actually inhibit endorphins and oxytocin and all the other hormones that we need.
Yeah.
And then that can make, well, creates tension in the body, which creates pain.
Yeah.
So it's giving them the breathing tools, visualization, affirmations, movement, and so many other techniques. It's a 12-hour course, so we go through a lot of stuff. And then also what's really important is a fear release. So we do a really beautiful meditation to release any fears or tension that we have, and empowering the partner because, you know, I think before doing this course, the dads feel like they have no role. Or the birth partners, they feel like they have no role. And when they come to the course, they're like, oh, crap, I actually have a lot to do.
Yes.
And sometimes they're like, yeah, let's get a doula because I actually have – there's so much to do that we need to outsource. And, you know, so, yeah, they have a really important role. And after the birth, what I find is that the mums always say, oh, I couldn't have done it without my birth partner. So, yeah, it's just a really beautiful experience for the both of them.
Yeah, I think that's the key part there. It's for both parties to really get so much out of that. But I loved what you mentioned about in terms of informed choice. Now, as a woman who hasn't had a baby, I haven't really been in that situation, but I'm a bit of a birth junkie like yourself.
Yeah.
Love all of the, you know, one born every minute. And I'm like, I am on YouTube watching birth vlogs and videos. I just find them so intriguing. And it's really interesting when you start to have an awareness around the choices that you actually have. And I've seen some birth vlogs where women are really in control, making their own decisions in their own lane, and other women where they just seem really out of control. I guess, how do you prepare people for that? Because I was watching a vlog recently, and I mean, I might be a little bit naive, but the mother was offered morphine as a way to kind of relax. And in my head, the face you just pulled was the face I pulled. I was like, oh my goodness, what? Why would you even choose that? So I feel like that's a pretty key part, that informed choice.
And I mean, it's not, it doesn't mean that's a bad thing if you choose morphine, but I mean, just the fact that a mum's offered something is massive, because when you are in labor, you're in labor land. Like, you don't care about anything. You're just so focused and just thinking about what is happening at that moment. And you're also highly suggestible.
Yeah.
So anything that someone says to you, anything that they offer, you're probably just going to be like, yeah, even if you don't want it. So this is why it's important to have birth preferences. So you discuss with your partner ahead of time, like while you're pregnant, you sit down and you talk about ideally what you want.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes to pain relief, you might ask, I do not want to be offered anything. I will ask when I want it. This is what I want to have first. So, for example, I want to try the gas first, or maybe I want to try the morphine, you know, but it's the mother's choice. Well, actually, it's the couple's choice. They've researched the benefits, the risks, and they know when this intervention is needed. And when they're making a choice like this, rather than being offered something and just kind of saying yes, they're less likely to have regrets. Because it's come from an informed and empowered place rather than just a fearful place or like submissive. So that's why a lot of my couples, they actually have in their preferences, please don't talk to mum, talk to the partner. And that kind of sounds a bit daunting at first for the partner, but because you've discussed everything and it's all in your preferences, you know exactly what to say. And then there's a really, really simple question that partners can ask, and that is, if something's offered, they can just say, well, is there any indication that mum or baby are in danger? Is there any any health issues arising? No? Okay, we'll just stick to what we're doing a little longer. Thank you. Just ask for more time.
Yeah.
Because if there's a, you know, a true emergency and something's needed, then they probably won't be asking.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like there's a little room for discussion, you know, like, yeah. Mm. So, yeah. But time I guess, is just a simple
yeah.
thing you can do. Yeah.
Asking. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I feel like, I mean, it's an overwhelming saturated market, so to speak. Like there's a lot of books, there's a lot of advice, there's a lot of information out there, but sometimes it's hard to know what you need to inform yourself about, like what your choices even are from the beginning. Because we can really see, for better or for worse, pregnancy and birth and labor glorified, or maybe positioned in a way where it's become something that we fear. And so I really liked how you talked about that notion of releasing fear around that, because that can be a huge thing and a huge block for women, can't it, going into a birth?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yep. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So you didn't just, I mean, you kind of did just fall into hypnobirthing through your own experiences. So I would love for you to share your, I guess, trajectory towards that path, and even a little bit about your history with PCOS, which I know is something that we share in common. I'd love to hear how that influenced your pregnancies and then what led you to the hypnobirthing realm.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all kind of linked, and I probably didn't realize it was linked till after, when I was releasing my fears about birth. But basically with my first pregnancy, I didn't expect that I would get pregnant, because I just had that idea that, you know, if you have PCOS, it's going to be hard. So it was a surprise pregnancy, which was great.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you know, shocked at first, and then I was like, okay, that's good, you know. Yeah. I'm pregnant, so it's good. Yeah. But I had massive fears about birth, mostly because I had shocking period pain.
Yeah, right.
And everyone tells you that birth is just like period, it feels like period pain. I was like, well, great, because I'm throwing up every day, not every day, but for the first day of every period, I'm in bed throwing up, and I have to take like a naprogesic or whatever I used to take at the time. And so I thought, well, if I need drugs to get through that, I'm going to need drugs to get through the birth. But then at the same time, I had started this path of, you know, being more mindful of what I put in my body, and avoiding chemicals and toxins to, I guess, give my baby the best start. And then I thought, well, I'm scared of the side effects of the drugs. So I was scared of the pain, and I was scared of the drugs. So basically I was just, I mean, screwed either way, really. And that pain, that fear of pain actually led to me having a more painful labor. And basically after a few days of early labor symptoms, I just went into the hospital and I said, just like, I've had enough of this. Like, let's get this show on the road. And then, you know, when they checked me and they said, you're 2 centimeters dilated, I said, I don't know if I can swear, but I said, F you.
Yeah, you can swear.
Okay, great. get this baby out. And so they induced me. I had an epidural, which led to me having forceps, because I couldn't feel the pushing. So I had forceps. And, I mean, also had morphine at some point. So I had, you know, hashtag all of the things.
Yeah.
But C-section. And, you know, that doesn't define a negative birth. I always say this, I always stress this, you know, natural birth doesn't mean positive. And interventions doesn't mean traumatic. But it was the way that I felt after the birth. I just felt like a patient going in for a procedure, do whatever, I have no power over my body. I just want it to be over. So that's why when I got pregnant with my second, I wanted to avoid that. I had as well been, you know, even more mindful now of what I was putting in my body as I was breastfeeding my first, and you know, well, with the first baby, everything's organic.
Food.
You know, we don't do that with the second, but we we aim as much as possible. But you know,
you're way more relaxed, right? That's what everyone says. Relaxed. Yeah,
yes, definitely. But still, I was like, oh, you know, I'm so worried now about, or I'm reluctant to take Panadol when I'm pregnant. So it's just weird to me that I'm going to avoid Panadol, but, you know, shoot me up with everything in the labor. That doesn't make sense. So I had to look further into that, and
look at my fears and why I was feeling this way. And that's what led me to hypnobirthing.
Yeah.
And in the first 10 minutes, I was like, oh my God, I think I can do this. I think actually I can aim for as natural as possible, you know, with the circumstances that I'm given anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, my hubby was sold. He loved it. He was so good in the labor. He used all the tools, helped to keep me calm. And I just labored pretty much at home the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
My husband was a bit like, maybe we should go to the hospital after a few hours. I was like, no, I'm good. I'm good.
Mm.
Even though my surges were coming like every few minutes. He's like,
I think we're getting close. I don't want to really, you know, catch this baby at home. But I was just so happy and comfortable. Mm. And I just kept comparing it to my first. And just kept thinking, it's nowhere near as bad as my first. And I was only, you know, 1 or 2 centimeters when I went in to the hospital. And I just kept comparing. I said, no, it's nowhere near as bad. So I'm just going to wait till it gets close to that feeling. And it just never got there. It never got to that feeling. So luckily my waters broke at home. So I thought, okay, maybe we should go. And I got to the hospital and half an hour later I started pushing.
Wow.
On the toilet.
Oh my goodness.
They carried me off the toilet. So I, you know, get on the bed on all fours, pushed him out in 10 minutes. And it was just so empowering. Just the, I mean, the whole experience was, but even just comparing how I pushed, you know, from being on all fours, like upright, listening to my body, just, you know, bearing down when I felt the urge in comparison to my first, where I was on my back, I couldn't feel anything. I had a catheter, I had the epidural in my back, I had IV fluids, I had syntocin, and then the monitoring straps and just like all, you know, it was night and day. So, after I gave birth to my second and, you know, I was like, if I can do this, then anyone can do it. Because I'm such a wuss.
Yeah.
I'm so scared of pain. You know, so there was nothing that special about me except that I had done this course. And of course it was my second, so that made things a little easier.
Yeah.
So that's what led me, a very long story, but that is what led me to teaching the program. I thought if people like me see someone like me who, you know, they can relate to, it's not someone who, you know, there's nothing wrong with hippie birth workers. Like, that's awesome. They're lovely. But a lot of people can't relate to that. Seeing someone like them going through it, I think, maybe we'll, I guess, give them more hope that they can achieve a positive birth too.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I definitely agree with that, because when I was having a look at your website and just trying to understand hypnobirthing a little bit more, I guess people can look at it and being like, you're hypnotized like during the birth. And I know that's probably a misconception, right, around it. It's more about your mindset and the languaging that you use. Like, even in, you know, sharing your story, you talked about contractions being surges, right? So changing the languaging, changing the dynamic, is that pretty much the pivotal like part to the hypnobirthing program?
Yeah, that's right. So it's changing your thought patterns, creating new thoughts, and new neural circuits. So, you know, we have all these negative connotations to the words like contraction and pain. So we change our language and we're creating this new positive language. So instead of thinking pain, we think sensation, intense, tightening. You know, don't get me wrong, you're going to feel it.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to sneeze the baby out.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, like you can feel it. Your body's working. It's doing something. It's, you know, your uterus is a really, really strong muscle. So you're going to feel it. But instead of thinking pain, because pain means something is wrong, intense sensation means that your body's working. It's like doing a good workout. You're going to feel it. If you don't feel it, you haven't worked out enough.
Yeah.
You know, you love that feeling the next day when you're kind of like tender and you feel like, burn. But if it's painful, then you've pulled a muscle. It's different.
So it's instead we're thinking, you know, your body is doing something, it's working. So thinking of it as intense sensation, and instead of contraction, thinking surge, because a surge comes and goes, or a wave. A lot of people like the term wave. So a wave comes, it reaches a top, the top of the peak, then comes back down, and then there's nothing for a while. And that's exactly what your surges are like in labor. If you time labor, it's mainly rest.
Yeah, that's true. But everyone gets super oriented and focused on the pain aspect or the contraction or the surge part of it. And I can imagine, like, I guess you can kind of relate it to, you know, everyday sort of things when something happens and you can feel your body tense up. Like, I can imagine how counterintuitive that would be if you're like, oh no, here it comes, like a pain's coming, like, and your body would just kind of like seize, as opposed to being like, okay, like relax into it, into the process.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why the breathing comes in handy. So, you know, sometimes we're, when we feel that feeling, just start to tense up, and that tension is going to create pain. So it's just remembering to like flop your entire body and then do your breathing and, you know, whatever the visualization that you're using, if it's visualizing a wave or something like that.
So and that's then, that's another part of it, the visualization in terms of.
That's right.
Yeah.
And affirmations are another massive one as well, to help you create those thought patterns. So using positive affirmations, things like I'm strong, or every surge brings my baby closer.
That's a nice one.
Instead of fearing the next contraction, you are like, oh my gosh, I'm getting closer, I'm one step closer, and just thinking about that wave at that moment instead of, you know, dreading the next one. Reframing that with positive language and affirmations is a big one. And then, you know, the self-hypnosis, like you said, it can be misunderstood, but hypnosis is just a normal state of mind.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in hypnosis daily. If you're on autopilot driving, that's the state of self-hypnosis. If you get lost in a book or a movie, that's the state of self-hypnosis. So that's the kind of state you want to be in. So a fully focused state, that's what you want to be in when you're giving birth, like being on autopilot.
You're
on autopilot, you're just letting your body do its thing, and you're focusing on whatever you need to focus on.
I love that notion and that concept of, I mean, it kind of takes the pressure off you a little bit if you're like, all right, you just do your thing and I'll follow suit. Just see where you want to go with this.
That's right. And you just turn your thinking brain off. That, you know, analytical, rational brain, and you, that's where the partners, they're the brain, they're going to be the thinkers, and you're just letting your body do its thing, and you're focusing on your visualizations or your affirmations, or whatever you need just to get you through each wave.
Yeah. And you mentioned before as well that the program isn't necessarily catered towards women who want a natural birth. I guess, how does it cater to the, I guess it's a mindset thing, which is first and foremost, but, you know, how do you go about catering towards all different types of birthing experiences?
Yeah. So those techniques can be used for anything. And I mean, if you think about it, if you're induced, you'll probably need those techniques more. You'll need the breathing more because it's going to be more intense. Or if you have a cesarean, there's a lot of women who are scared of needles even just the idea of the cesarean. You know, so actually a lot of my clients have more fears regarding medical procedures rather than the birth itself. So we also have to work on releasing those fears. But yeah, using the breathing and the visualization and, you know, sort of those distraction techniques when the cesarean section is happening. And then also we go through your birth preferences and what you can put in for, you know, in case of induction and in case of C-section. So things like for a C-section, simple things like lowering the drape when the baby's coming out. So you can see more your baby. Connection. Skin to skin, immediate skin to skin during a C-section. We know that's so important. So for the mum and the baby. So getting that immediate bonding time so you don't miss that moment. That is the most – that's the most rewarding moment in birth, is when you get that baby on your chest. So why should a mum who needs a C-section have to miss out on that? It doesn't make any sense. So I had a client recently send me her video of her cesarean section with twins.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And she actually had the drape fully lowered. And she closed her eyes. So they told her just to close her eyes because she didn't want to see. So she just closed her eyes. And then once the baby started emerging, they told her to open her eyes. Mm. They took the baby and placed the baby straight onto mum and then did the same thing with the next one.
Yeah.
Cords intact, left the delayed cord clamping. Yeah. So if they can do that with two babies, there's no reason why they can't do that when a mum has one baby. Right.
Yeah. C-section. Totally.
And, you know, breastfeeding on in recovery, all those things can still be done. So you still have preferences. And that's important. So that's why that gives the mum a sense of, I guess, control. I mean, we need to let go of control, but also it's nice to control what we can. So,
yes.
You know, yeah, giving that and taking the clinical part out of a C-section or an induction, or an epidural. Like if you have an epidural, you don't have to be on your back. You know, we teach that there are other positions. You can lay on your side and your partner can hold your leg up. So you're taking the pressure off your pelvis and that helps the baby come through the pelvis. So there's like all these different things that we teach to bridge the gap and bridge the hormonal gap as well, because there's a beautiful hormonal flow that happens in spontaneous and natural labor.
Yeah.
And we want to minimize that gap so we can, you know, still get as much oxytocin flowing for the baby's development and also the mum's ability to bond with the baby.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that's so important. It just comes back to that whole point around education and knowing the scope in which you have to work within. I'm not sure if this comes up much in your teachings with cesarean births, but vaginal swabbing. I don't know. Yeah, people like don't talk about that enough, I don't think. You know, when you have a cesarean birth, like the baby is missing out on a lot of bacteria that they receive through the vaginal canal. So there is an option there to ask that. But I don't think women naturally, like through the gynecologist, are not always at least encouraged or informed about that process and having that awareness. And even you touched on the delayed cord clamping as well. I'd love for you to touch on that a little bit more on why that can be so important for women to just kind of pause on that for a moment and not go for it straight away.
Yeah. So, I mean, the cord actually holds about a third of the baby's volume of blood. And that's important for, you know, the nutritional benefits because there's rich iron stores in there. So it's going to keep them for the 6 months that they're not getting as much iron from the breast milk.
Yeah.
So that's going to increase their iron stores even at 6 months of age, which is crazy. So that's nature's design for you. And there's also stem cells and all this beautiful stuff that the baby is naturally designed to receive after their birth.
Yeah.
And this is important for cesarean births as well, and especially important for preemies. So babies born early.
Yeah.
And so when we were born, we probably would have had those cords cut straight away, clamped and cut.
Yeah.
Even as recently as 2015, that's when I birthed my daughter, and it was just immediate, clamped straight away. And she probably needed that more because she had a little bit of a traumatic experience coming out. So that probably would have been great for her. But anyway, so by the time I'd birthed my son, so that was 2018, it was standard to wait a minute. And I think that's they won't cut earlier than a minute usually. That's the definition of delayed cord clamping. But if we look at photos of cords, you know, it takes around 15 minutes or more for that cord to become white and limp instead of being that really thick consistency, which is pretty much like the jelly of your eyeball.
Yeah.
That Warden's jelly, and that starts to then dry up in the air and kind of shrivel.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, it's blue at first when the baby comes out because it's oxygen rich, lots of blood and oxygen in there, and then it will drain and become white. So when the, you know, birth partners are cutting this cord, it should be white and stringy.
Yeah.
Nothing left in there.
Yeah. That's so important. I've heard the same thing around the 15 minute mark, allowing it whatever time it needs really to drain fully. Now I'd love to get your take on a few things, and this might just come down to personal preference, or maybe you have something to share from the hypnobirthing course. But I guess we've talked about natural birth versus cesarean, or I guess, intervention in birth, but what are your thoughts on like home birth versus hospital birth and preparing for those, and I guess the choices that women have around those birth types as well?
Well, if you asked me 5 years ago, I would say, hell no.
Yeah.
But the more and more that I'm learning about the hospital system and how most hospital policies and systems are not created to promote natural birth, and they're more there for the protection of the staff, the more that I see that home births are a really safe and smart option. So the research, there's some really good evidence that's come out recently looking at women who birth in hospitals and actually compared birth centres and hospitals and then home births. And they found that women who birth at home are less likely to, well, they're more likely to have a spontaneous vaginal birth, less likely to have C-section. So that's that includes the women who are transferred. They're less likely to have C-sections or an instrumental birth. Less likely to have third or fourth degree tears or postpartum hemorrhage. And more likely to be satisfied in their birth experience. So there are lots of and there are increases in mortality rates for, for babies. So you know, it is a safe option. And what happens in a home birth, depending on I guess where you live, in some places they have hospitals that offer home births, so you have your own midwife in the hospital, but she actually will come to your house for the appointments and then come to your house for the birth, and then you know, you would transfer to that hospital if something came up during the birth or during your pregnancy. So you'd go to the hospital setting, and that's completely free. But if you don't have that in your area, then you can actually hire a private midwife. And not many people know about this. They know about private obstetricians, but actually you can have a private midwife. And she comes to your house for your appointments and is on call for your birth. There's a second midwife who also attends your birth, so she's on call as well, because there always needs to be two midwives, one for the baby and one for the mum.
Yeah.
And then again, you know, if there's anything that comes up that indicates that there needs to be a transfer, you transfer to the hospital and your midwife will she'll continue to be either your doula. Or if it's a hospital where they have visiting rights, then they can take on your care, so they can be your midwife in the hospital. So there's lots of options there. And even just, you know, even if there was a transfer, just having that person who is your advocate and has been there from the beginning is just is so good. And all the research shows us if you have continuity of care, so that means you know your midwife, and she's at your birth, you're more likely to have, again, spontaneous vaginal birth and have even increased rates in breastfeeding, decreased postpartum depression. Like, it's just amazing. So having your midwife throughout your pregnancy and your birth is the gold standard of care. Too bad it's not offered everywhere.
I know.
So in New Zealand, it's like the standard.
That's
why the Prime Minister went through public, because she's like, oh, get my own midwife. And,
You know, interesting.
So this is recommended by World Health Organization, recommend that low-risk women, which is the majority of us, have their own midwife.
It seems like a bit of a no-brainer, hey, like to have, especially in the context of what you were speaking about earlier, in our body's capacity to naturally know what to do in these situations. I think we're so quick to just hand on the baton to someone else and go and put them in control of what we're doing, whether that's a doctor or whomever in that situation or setting. And
that's
I mean,
I was just saying about the obstetrician thing. I used to think that, you know, if you are able to afford private health, like, why wouldn't you go with an obstetrician? Like, aren't they the expert? And I've since learned that an obstetrician is an expert in high-risk pregnancies and surgery. So have a think, like, why are you booking a surgeon?
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
do you want a surgery?
Yeah, so you know, true.
And so, like, if you're low risk, unless you know that, you know, C-section is a high probability or you need specialist care, there's actually no reason why you need a surgeon to oversee or to actually be a part of your pregnancy or birth. They should just kind of be there in case. So if I do have a client who goes with an obstetrician, I always say, ideally, you're paying them to do nothing.
Yeah.
Just sit back and do nothing.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I really like that way of framing it and looking at things. And I guess through my own independent research and just being really curious about this, I've always felt, well, not always actually, more recently, I've felt more of a pull towards that home birth experience and just being in the comfort of your own space. And I guess not having, I mean, I don't like hospitals for, you know, any reason whatsoever, unless you absolutely have to be there. So for me, like going into that space, I'd find that really stressful. Like I would just, all the machines and all the lights and like everything like that, I feel like that can really, really throw some people off. And I know that would really put me off. And I know there are birthing suites and there are so many different options. And I guess neither one are right or wrong. It just depends on personal preference for the individual. But I wanted to bring up, I guess, the distinction between midwife and doula, because I know more and more women are usually having a combination. I mean, you have to have the midwife there, obviously, but then having the doula support as well. Is that something that you cover off in the program, or what's your personal belief around having a doula support?
Yeah. So a midwife is a trained medical professional. And you can think of the midwife as more the physical, she's in charge of the physical and the health of the baby and the mum.
Yeah.
And also the, like, you know, emotional support, but the doula is more in charge of that social, the spiritual and emotional kind of side of things.
Yeah.
And a doula is a paid support person to who has more expertise and tools under her belt. So they've had extra training and experience with women who have been birthing, and they know what to do, you know, if things stall, or they know what to suggest, what kind of positions to suggest, or they know to keep mum on track if maybe she starts to you know, move away from her preferences or starts doubting herself. She kind of can be there to put that trust back and also prompt the birth partner in what to do. So the doula doesn't take over. They don't come and you know, steal the show. Yeah. So, you know, it could be simple as just reminding the birth partner to do this type of massage, or, you know, or showing the birth partner what acupressure points to do, or just, you know, going out and getting everyone drinks, or taking photos, or, you know, whatever you need them to do, they're there.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said before, I have birth partners come in, and then they wouldn't ever think of getting a doula. And then once they come to the course, they see how much they have to do, and they think, right, yeah, we need a doula.
Yeah.
So it's good to support both of them, and it takes that load off the birth partner so that the birth partner can be present with mum.
Yes.
Yeah. And they don't need to be thinking about, like, setting up the room and, you know, doing all those other things. They can just be present with the mum, doing the massage and, or, you know, whatever the mum wants them to do.
Yeah.
And a doula is really important when we don't have that continuity of care.
Yeah.
So when a mum doesn't know her midwife, or has an obstetrician who – really, your obstetrician doesn't come until that baby's coming out. Even if you go private, you might have a few different midwives during that shift, the shift changes. So that doula is your constant, as well as a birth partner. But the doula is there to help advocate for you, help the birth partner to, you know, use their techniques to make informed decisions as well, just having the extra person there. And just having extra tools.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess you're right in terms of the birth partner, while, you know, you can share the load with them, get them across, like, the birthing plan and you know, the preferences, like you said, you also want them to have a pleasant experience and not have to be, you know, monitoring surges or you know, overthinking things as well. Like, to be able to say, like, hey, someone else has got that covered, we can just, like, settle into this moment, I think is super important. And again, like, that's not something that I was super aware of until more recently, I'd only ever really heard of doula in the context of death doulas, actually. So supporting people that are near death, I guess, through ill health. But I didn't realize you could have it for new life, I suppose, in birth. So I think that's really an important one for people to be aware about. Now, I've seen you being quite active on social media talking about, I guess, water and its use in births. And at the moment, it's a bit of a contentious issue with coronavirus and restrictions and things like that. I guess twofold here in this question, the use of water, how supportive is that during birth for women? And then I guess if you want to touch on the relevance of what's coming up at the moment in relation to coronavirus and the restrictions, because it's been a bit of a shit show for women going through this. I can imagine it'd be so stressful to be pregnant and to be birthing in this climate, because they've really shifted the goalposts a lot in that way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, there's so many women who swear by using water in their labor. So using either the shower or being immersed in water in a bath can help relax you. So it relaxes your muscles so that you have less tension, which can then decrease the pain. Yeah. And just, you know, being in that warm water, being in a warm bath, it's kind of like a little bubble that you're in. And it gives you that extra safety and privacy, because that's our innate need when we're birthing. We need safety and privacy. We don't like to be watched, which is funny because we birth in a hospital, the majority of us, and we are watched. But we, as you know, like other mammals, if you think of a cat, for example, they like to birth in privacy. And away from other people, other cats. So, so you know, we're kind of the same. So when we feel like we're being watched, that can really slow things down. So being in a bath, that can give you that sense of privacy as well. It's also been shown in research to decrease severe tearing.
Yeah, right.
It makes mum feel more comfortable during her labour. So it's a great alternative to medical pain relief, or at least, you know, something you could try before you go to an epidural or something like that. And the problem now with the restrictions in some places, for example in Victoria, that are banning the use of water, means that they're actually advocating, and RANSCOG, which is the Association of Obstetricians, are recommending that you then have alternative pain relief like an epidural. And what happens when we have an early epidural is that it can slow the labor process down. So at least, you know, I'm not anti-epidural, but what we teach in the classes is to prolong or push it back as long as possible so that you give your body the best chance to get into that established labor. So when you get it, it doesn't slow it down too much. Or you're not on your back for too long, which is going to decrease your blood pressure and all sorts of things. So you want to push it back as much as possible. And then if we're advocating for early epidurals, then what are we going to be doing? We're going to be prolonging labor. We're going to be increasing the use of syntocin, which is synthetic oxytocin, to then counteract that and speed up the labor. And we know that synthetic oxytocin can increase the rates of postpartum depression, along with all the effects that it can have to the baby and the mom, and the ability to bond with the baby, breastfeeding, all those kinds of things. And that's a whole other topic on the overuse of synthetic oxytocin, but I won't go there. So that is a big problem with banning water, immersion and showers. And the Australian College of Midwives actually don't support this. So the majority of midwives, you'll find, because they are trained, or I guess they're having their code to advocate for women. The majority of them they don't agree with this. And, you know, there are some people, I'm not really sure, I'm not an expert on, you know, disease and virus transmission and stuff. But there are midwives who say, well, you know, it's diluting droplets if they're in the water, and we're not going into the water with them. So what is the point of this? And, you know, if the mum is in the bath, like I said, they're in that bubble and they're less likely to be touched, and all those things. You know, there is concern that the PPE won't be as effective if it's wet. But then can't we just you know, if it gets wet, can you just change it?
Like, yeah, surely you know, there's solutions.
So, yeah, I mean, look, it's mixed at the moment. Let's just hope that it passes. What I would recommend if you were in that scenario is that you stay at home as long as you can and use your own shower and your bath.
Yeah.
And seriously look into a home birth.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And even with that, like, I've always thought that water births are a bit icky. I was like, oh, do you really want to be in that? Like, but the more I've watched, I'm like, fuck, that looks so much more relaxing than being anywhere else. Like, I mean, I don't know. I'm a bit of a water baby myself. Like, you know, once you're in the water, you're like, this is my happy place. So I can imagine it would have all of those like relaxing effects. And I guess it'd be like floating on a cloud somewhat. Like, instead of being in a rigid position on a bed, like not feeling like you can really move your body, at least in water, you can kind of float a little bit or
relax. And it takes that pressure off your back as well, because it's taking the weight of the baby. So it's just feeling that nice floating sensation, especially after, you know, carrying this baby for 9 months. All this pressure on your back and
It seems like, you know, a lot of effort that you're putting in. You kind of want to make this last sprint as, I guess, as peaceful as you can possibly imagine it to be. And like we said earlier, there's so too many messages around it being hard work and painful and all those visuals that you see in movies. Like, I really think for people to go and watch natural home births, like on YouTube. I know you've recently done like a series on Instagram as well, people sharing their birthing stories. I think the more you can surround yourself with that, you know, coming into the system and hearing, oh, it doesn't have to be that painful. And even just the contrast between your two experiences is huge. It's, yeah, it's pretty inspiring.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Definitely recommend flooding with like positive videos and images and start that before you even think of getting pregnant.
It's so true though, because I know for me, like, I would have just thought that I had no control. I would have been like, go to a hospital, you know, get a gynecologist, OBGYN. Like, I would have, like, I wouldn't have had any idea that I had choices in the matter. And I think that's the most empowering thing for us, is to actually know that we have choices, that we can make our own decisions. Like, there are options. You don't have to go to a hospital. You know, there are birthing suites or there's home births, like all these different experiences. And you get to fundamentally choose what you want. And, you know, the first time you might choose one thing and then realize, hey, not for you. Like, I don't know, would you have another kid and maybe do it differently, do you think?
Yeah, I would definitely have a home birth for my next, unless there was any indication that I needed to be in the hospital. I would probably, just knowing what I know now, I would probably avoid the hospital unless I have a medical issue, because that's what hospitals are for. It's not for a normal process. You know, it's like, I saw a really good analogy the other week of comparing birth to sex, because it's very similar. Hormonally, and if you think about, you know, you need privacy when you're having sex, and it's the same oxytocin and all that kind of stuff, so it's very similar. And there was a good article written about, you know, they're saying, imagine this couple are talking about having sex for the first time with their doctor, and they say, we want to have sex at home, and the doctor's like, what? You're crazy. You need to come. It's dangerous. You know, you need to come and have sex in the hospital so that we can watch you and monitor you.
God, you know, that's so funny.
That would be crazy, you know, or every time you do a poo, you need to go to the doctor so they can watch you to make sure you're doing it safely. Like, birthing is a normal function for the body, normal physiological function for the body. And in very, you know, rare cases is medical attention actually needed, and that's why we have obstetricians and midwives. So of course they have a purpose. I'm not anti-medical. And I like to think of them more as like lifeguards though.
They're
just like there, you know, if you're lifeguards at the beach, they're kind of there, but you don't expect to see them unless there's a problem.
That's a good way to put it. That's a very interesting analogy. I think that'll really like sit in people's minds and they go, oh, interesting. I was curious to know, as we were talking, I had this thought with the hypnobirthing program and course. I know a lot can happen like pre-birth, like in those last few weeks where things can be a bit touch and go, and, you know, getting baby into the right position for the vaginal birth, et cetera, et cetera. Does the hypnobirthing program support in that phase as much as it does in the, you know, actual birth, but then also to add to that as well, you know, postnatal in that experience for women? Mm. Like, do you have support either side of the birth as well?
Yeah, so we do go through like the optimal maternal positioning techniques so that we can we go through some main exercises and talking about posture and things like that. So how you can promote baby to get into that optimal position, which is going to make their journey through the pelvis easier.
Yeah, yeah.
Which will therefore make the birth smoother. Yes.
Yeah.
And also some resources on, you know, who to see, like a chiropractor or a physio, things like that, that can help with the opening up more space or creating more space in the pelvis and the uterus. And then, yeah, looking at resources as well for postnatal stuff. But I do recommend that, you know, for breastfeeding and postpartum, that women look further into that and do some more research, because I feel like breastfeeding is its own class and postpartum is its, like, you know, there's so much to know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I definitely recommend reading more books for preparing your body through that postpartum phase and for breastfeeding as well.
Yeah. There's so many allied health care workers, practitioners, whatever you want to call them, that you can really draw upon and lean on throughout all phases. I know there's, you know, physios, like working on, you know, bringing everything back together, or even just checks, you know, getting back into movement practices. And I think, again, that's something where I think we're maybe limited in our understanding of where, how far the scope goes. Again, I think we place all that emphasis on the traditional landscape, medical landscape, in terms of going to the OBGYN and getting checks done there and not knowing how to support yourself. So you're right, I guess, looking for those people that can further support you down the line, you know, once you've conceived, given birth.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you find that as well doing the program? I mean, when is the best time to do the program? That's a question that's been on my mind, actually. Like, when's the best time to lean into that?
Yeah, so after 20 weeks.
Yeah.
I like the 25 to 32. I feel like that's ideal if possible. Yeah. Yeah. But then it's also never too late. You know, like I've taught women at 38 weeks.
Yeah, wow.
Who have, you know, found out about the program later and they're like, oh crap, is it too late? I'm like, no, it's, you know, at least it will be fresh in your mind.
Yeah, true.
But if you're doing it around that 25 week mark, you have more than enough time to set those new thought patterns and also become really, really familiar with the techniques. And then you have a lot more knowledge about the tests and things that will happen. You know, like the gestational diabetes, group B strep, a lot of those things that come up. And then I guess, yeah, giving you the guidance on where to look so that you can make informed decisions. You know, you don't actually have to do every test.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Seriously. Yeah,
like you don't have to do anything.
No, I know. Which I really want to talk to you about that actually, because that blows my mind with how, you know, even the scans and things like that, like you can elect what scans you want to do, when you want to do them, what tests you want to do. I feel like there's information overload with like test genetic makeup, and there's this $400 test and there's this other test, and like you have to know, you don't have to know. It's overwhelming. So I guess, can you talk to that a little bit in terms of the options that people have around testing?
Yeah. So, you know, depending on with what model of care you go with. So in the public system, you're usually going to be sent for maybe a dating scan if you have irregular periods or whatever. So you might get that around like, you know, I don't know, like 9-10 weeks or something like that, maybe even earlier, like when you find out.
Yeah.
And then there's usually the 12-week scan with a nuchal translucency scan. So they will do that and see what the odds are of Down syndrome.
Yeah.
And things like that. And then they'll do the morphology scan at 20 weeks.
Yeah.
So looking at all that, you know, because by then most of the structures should have formed, so just see if there's anything or anything that they pick up. And also looking at the position of the placenta to make sure it's not blocking. And if it is, then they might rescan closer to the date to make sure that the placenta has moved away from the cervix. Excuse me.
You're right.
Oh, I'm getting too excited there. So they'll at
after, as we get closer, then they might scan to see if the cervix, the placenta has moved from the cervix. And other than that, that's pretty much it through the public system. So two scans. And then you might elect to have the Harmony or NIPT test, where they test the genetics just through your through a blood test. So they'll check for chromosome and the so it's normally like Down syndrome and a few other things.
Spina bifida and things like
and
that as well. And neural tube defects. That's pretty early on.
I think So I think that is more in with the nuchal translucency scan. They'll also can like pick up the gender. In the Harmony test. So that's more accurate than like an ultrasound. And that's pretty much it. If you have a private obstetrician, you might be getting an ultrasound at every single appointment.
God, that seems overwhelming.
And we know that a lot of ultrasounds can pick up things that aren't really an issue. And so they might think, oh, yeah, this is potentially an issue, or this baby's big or this baby's small. And then you'll be sent for some more growth scans, because actually the obstetrician's ultrasound isn't really that sensitive. So if they pick something up, you actually need to be sent to a proper ultrasound place so that they can have a look at it. So you can be getting lots and lots of scans. So, I mean, obviously it's up to the individual, but the important thing to note is that we don't really know long-term effects of these ultrasounds. But we know in some countries like Germany, they say no more than two unless it's absolutely necessary. Like, you know, there's really a problem. We need to double check something before we're able to have a safe vaginal delivery. For example, if the placenta was blocking the cervix. So that's really interesting. But yeah, again, I'm not anti-scan. You know, like I definitely prefer to have them. Will I have as many as I did for my second if I have another baby? Probably not. I might just have one or two. Instead of like 100 or
I'm sure it feels like that.
It wasn't 100, but it was there were a lot of scans, at every single appointment. And that's what I found the difference between an obstetrician and through the public system, because I have done both. I found that through the private system, what my obstetrician did was just do scans at every appointment pretty much. And not really do other checks. Whereas my midwives would do the Doppler, so they would check the baby's heart rate. They would measure my belly. They would feel my belly. They would feel the baby's position. They would make sure they felt movements. They would talk to me about movements. Have you been feeling movements? How often? Blah, blah, blah. Because that's actually like one of the most important ways to see if your baby's happy in there, if they're moving and, you know, the movements are consistent and stuff like that. And I did not want have one discussion with my doctor about movements, about fetal movements, which is very interesting. Is that because, you know, they assumed I knew because I was a second time mum? I don't know. So, you know, maybe she was just busy at every appointment that we had. I don't know. I'm not going to say she doesn't talk about it, but, you know, like it was just very different. And I didn't even notice that. Until I read a study that showed people who had midwifery, like continuity of midwifery care, so they had a known midwife, they actually had less preterm births and less likely to lose their baby early. And I thought, I just kept thinking, why is that? Why is that? And then I kind of put it together that, you know, it could be a combination of not having those thorough appointments, you know, not having those 1 hour appointments. And feeling the movements and talking about them, and you have a relationship with the midwife who's like, they give you their number, like, let me know if you have, if anything comes up or if you have questions. So, you know, there's a few things I can only just, you know, hypothesize and stuff, but I just find that really interesting. The level of care is really different.
Yeah. And it's also like, it just seems so primal, like going back to the feeling and like getting in touch with what you're feeling within your body too. Like, what were we doing before we had all these scanning devices? Like, we probably were more tactile, more in tune with our body. We were feeling into things a lot more and going, okay, what's the metric here for where I'm at? You mentioned about the gestational diabetes test. Is that one that you did in your pregnancies?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
is that a compulsory test?
If you want it to be.
Yeah. See, I don't know if you did this with your PCOS, but I did it with my PCOS diagnosis, and that was a god awful test. Like, I was sick for a whole day from that, just because like the drink is what, like 75% sugar or something ridiculous. Like, it really, like, if that's not sending your blood sugar and insulin through the roof, I don't know what is. It seems counterintuitive, but anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it is a universal test in New South Wales, at least. I know in some places in the world it's not universal. So it's not, you know, recommended for everyone. They look at risk factors, or they do a blood test first and they see if there's any indication that that test is needed.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like there's a lot of things, like gestational diabetes and group B strep, that there's no clear cut answer. There's no right or wrong. So that's why I don't like to talk too much in my classes about what I would do. You know, as we're chatting here, it's a little bit different. But in my classes, I'm like, I don't really want to say what I would do, because I want you to make your own decision. Like, you look up the benefits and risks and look at your body, and also your instinct. What does your instinct tell you? You know, is this test good for you? Is it right for you, or it's not? You know, I had a client who went with an obstetrician, and she said she didn't want to do the test, and her obstetrician said, cool, no worries.
Yeah, okay.
You don't have any risk factors. I'm happy with that.
Mm.
So she actually declined group B strep and the gestational diabetes test. Yeah. So she found a really supportive obstetrician who is woman-centered and put trust in the mum, which is so important, because I think, and like with us, with the experiences we've had with our hormones and PCOS, we have this idea put into us that our body is a lemon. We've kind of failed with hormones. We need help. We need the pill. We need experts to help us. And then this kind of like carries on through to the through to the pregnancy. You don't have trust in your body. You're not in tune with your body, because you've been masking with, you know, with pills and all those things. And we just like lose that trust. So I feel like it's really important to get that trust in your body, even before you're thinking about kids, like just getting your hormones sorted, listening to your body, eating for your body, being mindful of what you put in there. Like, you're the expert of your body.
I completely agree with you on that front. That whole notion of trimester zero, like that period before you conceive, is so important. And, you know, spontaneous pregnancies happen all the time, and maybe you're not going to be as prepared as you would like to be, and that's totally fine. But it's really more about it being a lifestyle factor more than anything, like having good nutrition. And yeah, I completely agree with the sentiment in where you're coming from with hormone imbalance. And I see this a lot with my clients as well, where women are really like, I mean, I was told, I was only 23 when I was diagnosed with PCOS, and I was told to go see a gynecologist by my GP, because they're the, you know, air quotes, specialists. Yeah. And like, yeah, they are, of course, but specialist in their way of treating this, which was go on the pill. And I was like, I've just come off the pill, and that's why I've received this diagnosis. I'm not going back on.
That's right. Yeah.
And in the same breath, she was like, oh, you're going to really struggle to fall pregnant. So, you know, come back to me when you're ready, and we'll talk a treatment plan and, you know, drugs and all this sort of stuff. And I was like, this can't be it. Like, surely not. And I just like rejected every notion with that. I was like, nah, not doing that. Not listening to you. Like, no way in hell am I going to come back here and stress about whether or not I can fall pregnant, you know, taking away power yet again. And we really need to empower one another to know that there are options, and we can get our hormones back into control, and that can be a natural thing that we all experience, you know. Case in point for yourself, sounds like you didn't have any trouble falling pregnant, which is a beautiful thing. Yeah.
I mean, I was lucky in that I got the, my PCOS diagnosed when I was actually, I was 23 as well. So I didn't, it got really bad to the point where I didn't have my period for 3 months, and I thought, this is like, this is weird. So I said, I'm going to finally go and check this out. So I got my ultrasound with the gynecologist, and she said, you have cysts. And I said, what can you do about it? She said, you can go on the pill. And I was like,
no.
Mm.
So I can mask the symptoms. And then when I want to get pregnant, I'm even worse. Like, no, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at least I had a little bit of that knowledge. And at least I had a mum who didn't let me go on the pill when I was younger, nice. Even though I had painful periods. I just always knew. I don't think it was even just her, my mum putting, like, telling me that, you know, it wasn't always a great idea to be on the pill. It was just like I instinctively knew that, that it was just, it didn't make sense to me. So I'm really lucky that I didn't ever go on it. But once I got my diagnosis and I wasn't happy with the answer of this is the only way to fix it, so I just did my own research and I did it like an overhaul. I changed my diet. I threw out every product in my house almost. Like I was using like all these like bleach and like toilet chemicals. Products and whatever. I like literally threw everything out. And then replaced it, and then slowly started replacing my makeup, my skincare, everything. So by the time that I got pregnant, so that was like a year and a half later, I'd already made all these changes. You know, I wasn't even thinking about having a baby, but I went to a workshop about PCOS with Nat Klingoudis. I was just on it. I was like, I just wanted to fix myself because I didn't want to have difficulties later on. And also I just felt like I just want to fix it for just to have the optimal health because your reproductive system is a reflection of your overall health.
100%.
If you're not 100%, then your body's going to say, what's the first to go? Bye-bye, reproductive system. Mm-hmm. We don't need you to survive.
Yep.
So
now's not the time to be making babies.
Yeah. And so I learned to listen to my body, listen to my, look at my cycle, you know, and now even still, if it's like, I'm pretty regular now, which is awesome. I'm like 32 days. But if it's a little bit more, painful or my cycle's a little bit off, I really reflect on why that is. What happened this month? Was I a little bit more stressed or, you know, what did I eat? Like everything. And so it's just like, it's such important knowledge. I wish that this was taught to girls like before they got their period. Like your periods don't have to hurt. And if they hurt, this is your body telling you something isn't agreeing with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of those symptoms. Yeah. So true. I feel like it's the missing link in schools. Like we have all that sex ed stuff where I don't remember taking anything away from those lessons. And to be honest, we're probably too young in like grade six or whenever it is that we're having this thrust upon us. But yeah, when we are experiencing our cycle, we just get handed down these messages of, oh, that's normal. Oh, that's normal. Oh, that's normal. It's like, no, it's common. It's commonly experienced by a large proportion of women to have irregularities, to have PMS symptoms, to be irritable, you know, to lose their period. Like that is, you know, commonly experienced. It's certainly not normal. And I think it, again, disempowers women to go, oh, I can actually change this. And oh, like the thing, what I'm putting in my body 3 to 5 times a day by way of food is influencing my overall health and well-being. And yeah, getting your cycle regular and clearing out all of that stuff, I think irrespective of if you're looking to have kids at that present moment or down the line, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's really for your own health because we operate on our cycle, like as women in that infradian rhythm, that month long process, like what that's how we operate, how, you know, our body will change so much in that month. Whereas men, circadian rhythm, like day in, day out, their testosterone is constantly being reproduced. So, you know, apples and pears, like you can't lump everyone in the same category, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like that, you know, how we are conditioned to fear birth. We're also birth and periods and all womanly things. It all comes together. Like when that shame was introduced with birth, that shame was introduced with periods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were supposed to be cursed with period pain and labor pain and you know, we had to hide you know, like I remember my grandma would have to hide her stained underwear and dry, like, you know, wash them in secret and dry them somewhere in secret, and so we have this like shame instilled in us and we hate our period and you know, like imagine if you again woke up every day and you were hating going to the toilet. Like, that's not normal. You should, like, I love going to the toilet. I'm like, yes, it's a good poo. Like, I'm healthy, you know?
Yeah, totally.
It's a reflection of your health. And, like, you know, it's probably a little bit nicer than a poo, your period, because it's like, you know, that's your womb. That womb brings life. Like, this is, you know, it's like a sacred thing.
Yeah, it really
and
is.
I actually am happy when I get my period every month now. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, cool, you know.
Yeah.
And even if it's intense, it's certainly not painful anymore. It's intense. Mm. Like, I do sometimes I'm like, I feel like my vagina's going to fall out because it's so heavy.
Yeah.
But I don't get cramps like that. Like, it doesn't hurt anymore. Mm. And I love that. I'm like, oh, cool, you know, like I'm doing all the right things for my body. And, you know, appreciating it and not dreading it every month. And that's why, you know, girls are like, I don't want my period when I go on holiday. It's such a nuisance. I don't want this. So I'm going to go on the pill.
Skip
so it's
it.
Like, yeah. So there's like a lot we need to do, I guess. It's not just all about like you need to avoid the pill. There's like all this work beforehand as well. It's like, I guess it's up to us to teach our daughters not to, you know, be afraid of your period you know, have to hide it. It's not dirty. It's not disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sign that you're healthy. And then, like, teaching our boys as well.
Yeah, I agree.
It's all on the girls, you know, teaching our boys about this.
Yeah. I remember being in school and I was pretty young when I got my period. I would have been around 12. And I remember being so, like, ashamed. Like, my sister and I got them in the same year and she's 2 years older. And I was like, fuck, what? Why? And then it was just not a fun time. And yeah, I remember like you just don't talk about it. And now me and my girlfriend's like, oh, I've got my period, like blah, blah, blah. Like, I think I'm feeling a little bit menstrual. Like, I feel like we're slowly getting better about like communicating on that. And even now, like, you know, with my boyfriend, like, there are times I'm a bit cagey and then sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to lay it all on the table here. Like, you don't know unless you know. And like, boys and men shouldn't be brought up to fear that. They should actually want to know and want to have an understanding around that. I think, like, we get their anatomy and not much is going on, I guess, for them, but a lot happens for us in a month. So, you know, it's good for them to have that awareness. And like you said, it brings life. So why fear something that's that powerful, you know, and whether that's physical life, creative energy, however you want to view it, I feel like it holds a lot of power in that space.
Yeah.
This has been rad. I've absolutely loved talking all the things with you. I'd love for you to just kind of give us a little recap on, I guess, the courses that you offer, because I know you offer group programs, personal, like individual programs as well. And I guess coronavirus has changed the landscape of things somewhat. So I guess you're more flexible with being online at the minute too.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the Birth Collective and how you work and how people can find you.
Yep. So you can find me on Instagram, the.birth.collective, or my website is thebirthcollective.com.au. And I offer, so you've got all my courses on there. So I offer group courses and face-to-face private courses in Western Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
But I do teach private courses on Zoom.
Yeah, nice.
So I just wrapped up some classes with a couple from South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently teaching a couple in Brisbane. So it has been awesome actually to connect with all these couples when, you know, I probably wouldn't have before this time because, you know, so many classes are being cancelled and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's great. So I've got those private options as well. And then for those who, you know, they might not be able to fit in a face-to-face or Zoom course, or they're looking for something more self-paced, we've got the HypnoBubs online course that you can do in your own time. And then if you want some personalization, we can actually just book in a 90-minute Skype session to go over anything and do a fear release and stuff like that. So, all of those details are on my website.
Yeah, awesome. I think it's great that you can open yourself up to so many more people across the country, because I guess a lot of the time you want to like find the right person. Like, I guess hypnobirthing courses, you know, so many people can offer them. But I mean, I love your energy and your approach to things and your lighthearted nature in it, just from what I've observed on social media. So I know if ever comes a time for me, I'll be hitting you up. Because I think you bring that energy.
I'll be waiting.
You'll be the first that I call. But thank you again so much for coming on the podcast and for sharing your experience and for, I guess, shedding some light on hypnobirthing and the birthing process in general. It's been awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into the podcast. I hope you got something magical out of this episode today. If you want to keep the conversation flowing, head over to the gram and you can find me at annalise.madrell, or stay up to date with the latest podcast episodes at Coming From Experience, all one word. Be sure to share this podcast with a special someone who you think might gain a lot out of this conversation, and be sure to leave a review and let me know what you think. Until next time.